This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From the 37 verses of the practice of a bodhisattva, verse 1. Now that I have this great ship, a precious human life so hard to obtain, I must carry myself and others across the ocean of samsara to listen, reflect, and meditate day and night with diligence is the practice of a bodhisattva. So this morning we're completing an introductory retreat that we've been doing this weekend with a group of you who have joined us from your homes and across the country and world, other continents. And we are in the early days of our Ango, in which we're studying this teaching and within the theme of the Bodhisattva. And so, as I mentioned before, I'll be working through these verses throughout the Ango. Somebody asked a question this morning, which is very reasonable. Why, given so much that's going on in the world, so much confusion and distress and disorder, why do we sit down to meditate? Is that selfish? And that question has probably always been asked. It certainly is asked in our time, in part because we are so aware, it's brought into our homes and into our minds, how much of the world is suffering and how people are struggling everywhere. And also because in our particular culture and society, we don't really value reflection. We value action. We don't value patience. We value immediate response, even if it's just a reaction. We don't really value contemplation. We value knowledge. Or actually, we used to. I don't know where that's at these days. And so it seems to cut across the grain. It moves against the stream. And to understand that never in Buddhism has there been the teaching of being passive, being complacent, being non-responsive to the suffering of the world. That's why the bodhisattva path is so important. Not only does it express our basic nature and our fundamental impulse in the world, which is to care about ourselves and others, but it also, in a way, provides a check, if you will, against those tendencies within a deep meditation practice in which we are cultivating calm, equanimity, serenity, acceptance. It helps to check against the possibility of those being misused or even mis-experienced, you might say, into a state of passivity. You know, when we talk about oppression, when we talk about suffering, we're talking about actual people. We're talking about real people. We're talking about ourselves, but we're also talking about other people who today, at this very moment, are in trouble, right? Of losing their lives, of losing their homes, of having lost their homes, of having lost the lives of people next to them, sometimes through natural disasters, sometimes through natural disasters that we see now have a human hand connected to them, like the fires raging on the West Coast. We see it happening as a result of intersecting systems of individual karma with historical karma, with institutions and systems that together work together and have been designed to work to put certain people, certain groups of people into advantage and certain other groups of people into disadvantage, which is a polite way of saying to bring benefit and well-being to some people and suffering and torment to others. And so we need to remember that in our Buddhist practice as bodhisattvas and bodhisattva on the path, because we use this language so much that we're talking about real lives. Sometimes it's hard to even to get that we're talking about our real lives, to cut through our all that sort of comes in between the actual suffering that we feel. Now that I have this great ship, a precious human life, so hard to obtain. I wanted to say something, too, about the study that we're doing of these verses. You know, Dharma study is very important. We have a lifetime of experience of reading, of listening. And Mazumi Roshi said it well, where he said there are different ways to study the Dharma, read the Dharma, hear the Dharma. He said we can memorize it, we can study it carefully, we can study it quietly, we can read it aloud, we can read it with our body, we can read it with our mind, and he said then there's reality reading. All of these are important. All of them have value. In a sense, all are leading to reading with your body and mind. And that leads you to reality reading or reality hearing. Hearing with the whole body and mind, but more. Where the Dharma is hearing the Dharma, where Buddha is receiving the teachings of Buddha, where things as they are encountering things as they are. That's really what practice is about. Coming home is really reclaiming our natural place as something which is as it is, this body and mind. And so with all of our projections and mental afflictions and emotional entanglements and ideas and so on, you know, all of that prevents us, gets in the way of experience ourselves and the world as it is. It's constantly like putting more and more layers of paint, right, to hide what we perceive as stains or scars or blemishes. And so for the real you, to meet the real. And so in studying, we have to really study carefully. These teachings are very important. I would suggest read one verse at a time. You know, and this also, you can sit down and just read through it and read it carefully to take in the whole of the teaching. But week by week, to study one verse, to take it in, to memorize it, to hold it in your mind, to reflect on it. This is the ancient way. This is what the Buddha said we need to do to engage deeply. And that's why there are commentaries that are presented, because these verses are very terse, right? That's the nature of a certain sort of body of teachings. It's just the heart of the matter. Very, very concise. With the understanding that you, or with the help of a commentary, we'll be able to open it up and see all that's there. So what do we know? Today, you're alive. That much you know. This life will end. That too, you know. Right? You do know that, right? Is knowing this enough? Does knowing these truths sit on the surface of your skin? Does it reside in your tissue? Does it run through your blood? Is it in the marrow of your bones? Being alive, having this life, what are we doing with it? How are we using it? This is not something that's happening to us. It's not something that was given to you and then gets taken away. Moment by moment, you're creating it. I am creating it. And we're doing that together. What are we creating? This is why understanding karma, studying our karmic history in our mind, studying our world history, our cultural, social history is important, because we realize it's all woven together. How could you take it apart? How do you know what is, how much of your thoughts are yours? Right? When you have a desire for something, sexual desire, well, that's biological. But when you feel sexual desire, is that purely biological, or are some elements of that desire, the intensity of it, the focus of it, what's included in that and what's not, how much of that is socialized? Can we even know that? This great ship, a precious human life. All things are forms of reality. All things are complete unto themselves. Stogen says, everything, animate and inanimate, covers the ground upon which it stands. All things, even deception, appears without deception within itself. Why is a human life precious? We hear that and we think, you know, we think in sort of the dominant motto, that we're better than everybody else because we say so, and we can. We can write it on a piece of paper. Other things can't do that, right? That's not what it means. It means that a human life is precious because, being human, certain doors open, certain things become possible and available to us. We have a range of impact that we can see and that we don't see. And so this human life, this preciousness of this human life, is understood within the six realms of existence, which can be understood as different possible realms that we can be born into, realms that we certainly create, and in creating them, we may dwell in certain realms, have a certain proclivity towards certain realms or a certain affection towards certain realms, return there again and again. And in that, they become paths, they become realms, kind of, you could think of them as devotions. And each of these realms has consequences. And so the what are called the lower realms, the hell realm, which is just unending agony. The hungry ghost realm, which is unending thirst, unquenchable thirst, insatiable hunger. The animal realm, which is a life bound by dogma, by doctrine, by rule, by boundedness. And that these realms are considered so occupied with struggle and pain and delusion that genuine spiritual practice is just not really available. Not because these beings are inherently incapable, but because their minds are so preoccupied, our minds are so preoccupied in these realms, that the turning towards spiritual practice is just not likely. In the other side of the scale, God realms, we have the angry gods who are angry because the prideful gods live above them, right? It's like you have an incredible apartment, but you don't have the penthouse. And so you're upset about that. And so the angry gods are angry. So they're at war all the time, but they live like gods. The prideful gods are not at war. They're just asleep. They're so full all the time. They're so sated, so quenched all the time. Life is so good that they live in a state of sleep. And in that, they cease to continue to develop themselves, and so ultimately it all comes apart. So in the God realms, the minds are too distracted with so much pleasure, so much abundance. So the human life is considered propitious, because auspicious, we might say, because we live long enough to get to suffer. Right? We live long enough to get knocked around, to realize life is difficult. We get old, we get sick, we die, we hurt each other. We're confused. But we don't live so long that in recognizing that, we don't have time to do something about it. It's considered that suffering is sufficient to motivate us. There's enough of it to motivate us, but not so much of it that it overwhelms us. Right? And so in terms of thinking just of all of humanity or our individual lives, we can think about how we move in and out of states where we are in states where we are able to really turn our attention to hold such reflections in our mind, and other times where the world or the consequences of our own actions or our internal states so press in that it pushes out, right, the ability to reflect and stop and say, wait a minute, where am I? What am I doing? And of course, there are realms that we create, that people create for other people, which is the realm of injustice, where people's lives can be so made so difficult that it can be difficult to do more than survive. But the thing about being in the human realm is that all of these other realms are impermanent, as is the human realm. But in the human realm, even when we step into or move into or are thrust into these other realms, we're not fixed there. I remember a letter I got years ago from an incarcerated man who began by saying that his whole life had basically been a war. Him against everyone and everything. And that he ended up in jail, in prison, and the war continued, and he fought everything and everyone. That was what his whole life had been about, and he was thrown into solitary confinement, and he went to war in that. And he described a moment where he had been put into a straitjacket and maced, and he said he ceased to be a human being. He was like some sort of creature to himself. And sitting there writhing in his solitude, in his confinement, in his straitjacket, in mace and vomit. And slowly, exhausting himself, the thought came into his mind as though for the first time, to what end? To what end is this? And he realized there has to be something more. That's the power of the human realm. That when we're in a place that seems unretrievable, inaccessible, even to oneself, it's not. Now, of course, every human life is important, is sacred, is to be respected, has dignity. In Buddhism, a precious human life means something, and that's important. Right? Because we might just say, oh, sure, human life is precious, but in Buddhism, this actually means something particular. And what it means is that a precious human life is a particular human life that has certain conditions present so that it is conducive to encountering the way. And so it said that there are 8 unfavorable conditions which will make this difficult. 1, you're born into a hell realm or into a hungry ghost or animal realm. In other words, you're born into a realm, you live in a realm in which it's going to make it very difficult for you to encounter the way. Or that you're born amongst a clan that is so deluded that the thought of spiritual practice or of sort of deeper, wanting to understand the deeper interior of things is just not part of that landscape. Or you're born among the gods who are so self-satisfied that the thought never enters. Or you're born in a place where the Buddha Dharma isn't present. So you might have an inkling, you might have that impulse, but it's not met. Or you're born without the sufficient capacity, just physically, mentally, to be able to actually engage, because it does require, practice does require a certain sort of basic capacity of our human faculties. So those are the eight unfavorable conditions. But that's not enough, because we can, those cannot be present, but there are certain favorable conditions, the teachings say, that need to be present in order for us to actually manifest that precious human life. We have to be born human. Right? And a lot of times people react to the animal realm. It's like, what's the deal with the animals? Right? Animals are cool and smart and intelligent and communicate and have empathy and so on. Certainly some of them do. And there's so much we don't know. But it's, so let's just not get hung up in that, okay? Animals are fine. What we're talking about, what we're talking about is us, right? Sort of that part of us that gets caught. Right? So we need to be born human. We need to be born in a place where we can actually encounter the Dharma. You know, one of the things about this pandemic is that we're meeting so many people, you, some of you, who live in places far, not only far away from us, but far away from any Dharma place of practice, any Sangha, any teacher. Or you're in circumstances where you can't travel, right? Sometimes it's life conditions, sometimes it's physical conditions. And so the place where you are is the place that you have. And so today, fortunately, you can, and you are, encountering the Dharma. But so we do need to be in a place where we can do that. We need to have sufficient faculties. We need to have lived well enough, made enough good choices, created enough good karma that we actually raise Bodhi mind, that we turn towards the Dharma, we seek it. And we have to have sufficient faith. Sometimes people encounter the Dharma, but their lives have brought them around to being so untrusting, so wary, so distrustful and suspicious. It's very difficult to hear the Dharma, right? And not just assume that there's something else going on. Those are considered internal conditions. There are five external conditions. We have to be born at a time where the Buddha has actually appeared. So even though the Buddha Shakyamuni lived 2,500 years ago, we are still in the period of time of Shakyamuni Buddha. That Buddha that appeared, Shakyamuni, has to have not only realized enlightenment, but to have taught the Dharma, right? So think about it. I mean, you know, the Buddha said he almost didn't teach. He just thought, it's just not going to work. People are too enamored of their attachments. They're too attached to their attachments. But he was implored, pressed upon to teach, and so he did. Thank you, our original teacher. The Buddha must have taught the Dharma. The teachings must still be present, right? What if they'd never written down the teachings? And people's memories started to fade, right? They have to still be present, and they have to still be being practiced. In other words, they can't just be on a dusty shelf somewhere. They have to be in people's bodies and minds that are practicing. And then we have to gain the possibility of studying with a Dharma and with a teacher. And so what all of this is helping us to understand, that this precious human life is precious because all of these things have to come together. And they don't always. They haven't always. They aren't right now for some. And so in our materialistic culture, 24-hour open for you box store mentality, where you can get anything, anytime, anywhere, we might think, well, yeah, of course I'm practicing the Dharma. Right? Isn't that my right? Hasn't everybody always? Can't everybody? And what these teachings are saying is no. No. And we should notice that. 72 labors brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. We should know how fortunate we are to be able to be here. Why? Right? Is that just like being scolded like a child? Or does that do something to you, to me, to know that, to reflect on that? Does it change things? Because if all of those things have to come together, and they have, that means they could come apart. Those conditions could end. Right? Just because they're here today doesn't mean they'll be here tomorrow. So it's precious because it's fleeting, because it is dependent, because it is empty of anything inherent that assures us that it is fixed and permanent. And so you can rely, you can put it on a shelf and walk away for a year or 10 years and know that when you finally get around to it, it'll be there again. Mm-mm. Maybe it will, but you won't. And so we don't waste the time that we've been given. It's said that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. We could also say, the teacher has appeared. Are you ready? The teacher might be standing in front of you. Are you listening? Now that I have this great ship, a precious human life, now I must carry myself and others across the ocean of samsara. Monasteries, Dharma centers are all impermanent. We practice here today, many of us, the monastics, devoting our lives, not just to our lives, but to the lives of everyone who will ever want to come to the Dharma and for whom those conditions are sufficient that they can arrive on this doorstep. Or arrive on this doorstep. It's not just for us. And what happens when it's not just for you or for us is it compels us to be much more diligent. Right? If you're just thinking about today, if we're just thinking about ourselves, it's easy to get sloppy, it's easy to be lazy. But when you think about trying to build something, sustain something, nurture something that will sustain itself, that will be here in 100 or 200 or 500 years, provided we're actually here, then we have to really reflect in a whole different kind of way. Which is really the way we should be living everywhere. I must carry myself across. Reflect on that. Right? Because remember, these teachings are being spoken directly to you, for you. When I study these teachings, I am receiving them specifically for me. These words are being given to me, for my practice. And so, do I understand that fully? Do you understand that fully? A good rule of thumb is just assume, no, you don't. Right? I mean, think about it. Because if you think, yeah, I've got it, I've plumbed the depths, there's nothing more, then you the door's closed. We're not hearing these words. We're not hearing the Dharma anymore. How can we reflect on it? How can we meditate? And so just assume, no, I'm not understanding all that this means. I have not yet fully grasped. I must carry myself. How wonderful. There's more for me to see about that, to reflect on. To the degree that you do understand that and have faith in that and are empowered by that, that's good. I remember in my own life when I was in high school, and really beginning to wonder, you know, like, what the hell's going on here? Does anybody actually know what's going on? Like, who do I turn to? Who's my inspiration? Who's my example? And I talked my girlfriend, who had a car, into, she was so nice. She would indulge me, and we would go to different churches on various Sundays because I wanted to see what's going on in there, because I grew up not in any church, not in any religion. What's going on in there? Because there's a whole bunch of people that think there's something very important going on in there. I wasn't yet one of them, but I wanted, maybe you know something, I don't know. And so we would go in and we sit there, and I was definitely an outsider. I really didn't know what was going on, but I was listening. And what I was really there for when I was watching was the people. And I wanted to see, is there something, do I see anything going on in you that I find inspirational, that I find the sort of a light of an example? Because if I do, then I want to know, what are you doing? And I wasn't thinking in terms of path. I didn't have that language. I really, in a way, didn't know what I was doing. But that's what I was looking for. Now I know that that's what I was looking for. And so when I encountered the Dharma, and both encountered these teachings, which so clearly I knew already before I had any reasonable grounds for knowing that, that these teachings understood something in a depth that I felt like I'd never encountered before, spoke to me in a way that I had never been spoken to. And I didn't realize it then, but I know now. I was wanting to listen. And finally I found something to listen to, and then I found what I was looking for, a path. Because I knew on some level I have to carry myself. I knew implicitly no one was going to do this for me. I must carry myself across the ocean of samsara with everyone. Samsara means wandering. Wandering. Within the realms of all of the various states that we inhabit, within all the realms of human possibility. But this wandering is not from a place of not knowing. It's not at ease. It is very tense. It's anxious ridden. It's wandering because there is no place that we find that is home. There is no place where we find that rest. And so we wander. And we jump from a low place to a high place and say, yippee! But then we jump from a high place to a low place. Oh. And we go looking for the next high place. We're fearful within the difficulties because we're afraid they're going to last forever. And we're fearful within the good times because we know they're not going to last forever. We expect external conditions and people and situations and relationships to provide us with what we seek, but they can't. Not that. And the good that we do have, we expect way too much. Way too much. The pain that we experience, we project way more than it is. This is the ocean that we're trying to cross. To listen so that we can listen and reflect and meditate with diligence day and night. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Master Huayan, an old master, used to sit on a rock outside his hermitage every day and call out to himself, "Oh, master." And then he would answer, "Yes." And then he would say, "Are you awake?" And he would answer himself, "Yes, I am." And then he would say, "Never be deceived by others at any time, in any place." And he would answer, "I won't." And this is a koan that we work with. And as a koan, it has to be, and it seems like a very, this is a wonderful koan because every student who takes it up thinks, "Oh, I already know. I get it. I have to carry myself across. I am the master." True. But does that change your life? Is that realizing the master? How? given how easy it is for us to deceive ourselves? Can Rayon be so confident in saying, I will not be deceived by others? Is that arrogance? Do we see something in examining the real that goes beyond the ability to be deceptive? But there's another way we can look at this koan, which is not really the way it's taken up traditionally. We can hear it as a kind of calling and answering to listen, to reflect, and to meditate with diligence day and night. Are you awake? Master, just calling. Does anybody answer? Yes. Okay, good. Someone responds. Are you awake? Are you being deceived? And so to hear, to read the Dharma, to receive it with the mind of the student, we have to want to, you see. I mean, that's the essence. That's why Buddhism can't and shouldn't proselytize. There's a difference between making the Dharma available and trying to convince someone that they should hear it. Right. They're not hearing it. If they are, you don't need to convince them. If they aren't, you're convincing them it's not going to work. Something internally has to happen. Something, some shift inside of us has to happen. That's the mystery of this precious human life. And only one who wants to understand can. Even though our wanting to understand is so often not understood by us. We don't actually understand all the time how we want to understand. But when our concern is casual, our hearing is casual. It's just that way. When our concern is deep and broad, we hear in a deep and broad way. That's why when we give instruction in how to hear a teisho, we say, listen as though it's being offered only to you, or you're the only one who's ever going to hear this. It's up to you to receive it. Right? Because what happens when we're all together, it's sort of like, well, if I don't get it, somebody else will. Or we can think, this isn't being offered to me, right? This, I don't immediately hear what you're saying. I don't resonate it. It doesn't fill my heart. The Dharma is not always like that. Sometimes it arrives, you know, alive and vibrant and, you know, it just jumps right inside of you. And sometimes it arrives like a dried up piece of burned toast, right? It's just like, there's no life here. There's nothing in here for me. That has nothing to do with me. That's why we have to have faith and listen. I remember I was thinking back on, you know, all of the many years, the many, many Sundays and sessions when I sat in this hall, as we are today, and listened to my teacher teach, and year after year after year after year. You know, and at a certain point, it was like, oh, he's going to tell this story. Oh, he's going to offer the teaching in this way, right? Right? I've heard this before. And I realized, you know, at a certain point, I mean, for a lot of years, it was alive, and I could hear it again, and I could hear it again, and it was still alive. And there was a point at which I saw that changing, and I realized, oops, watch it. Careful. Right? And I realized I was on a precipice where I could say, okay, right, I've heard this before, and just like sort of go to sleep until something new, something interesting appeared. And I realized that's the path of death. Right? So that's the path of dying while sitting upright. And so I decided I'm not going to do that. I'm going to listen. I'm going to hear my teacher's teaching. And I'm going to practice hearing this and know that there is something here I have not yet heard. You know, because this is the Bodhisattva path, which is based in bodhicitta, when that bodhicitta, that aspiration, that desire, that hunger, that urgency is not really there, or not very strong, it's sort of like, you know, there's a doctor in front of you telling you you have a grave illness, and they're giving you essential information about what to do, like what is the nature of the illness, what is its cause, how do you get the medicine, and what is your treatment? But without that bodhicitta, you're sitting there thinking, why are you telling me all this? I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. Or we might say, I hear what you're saying, but you know, it's really not as serious as you say. It's really not as serious. Like, what's really wrong with samsara? I'm having a good time. Or, I hear what you're saying, I know it's serious, but I've got it. I'm in control. Or, show me your papers. Who are you anyway? I don't really trust medicine. I don't trust doctors. Makes it very hard to hear. And so to remember, I have this great ship. It's a precious human body. Precious also means vulnerable. It means impermanent. It's so hard to obtain. I have obtained it. I must carry myself and others across the ocean of samsara. Do I understand samsara? Do I understand the first noble truth? Not just in my thoughts, not just as ideas, not just as something I could say back to somebody, but do I really get it? Conditioned existence is dukkha. Do I see that truth being played everywhere? It is the show that is in town. Do I see it in every news story? Do I see it on every day where I look? And so then reflect, take it in. Digest it. What do these words mean, these Dharma words? What do they mean? This is so important. We can't just rely on our basic understanding of English for words that have been translated into English and think that's what it means. What did the Buddha mean when he said these things? And to realize this is a direct point, it's pointing to me. If I don't get that yet, that's all it means. I don't get that yet. I don't understand how this teaching is talking to me about my life. But I can want to understand that. I was talking to a student recently who was struggling with some teachings that they found very dry, not interesting, not as interesting as other teachings, not as accessible as other teachings. And I was telling them about when I first started studying the teachings of the Majjhimaka, of Nagarjuna. And it was like, this is my burnt piece of toast. It's like, there's no flavor here. Like, this is so dense, this seems so intellectual. And I just felt like I was chewing, but not getting anything. And it would have been so easy to put away and just think, well, that's just not, this has nothing to offer me. But what kept haunting me was my knowing that these teachings were so foundational in the development of the Buddhism I am practicing and that I have devoted my life to. How is that? Right? They can be so important, and I'm not able to understand how that is true. And so I would read it, and I would put it down, and then at some point I would come back again and take it up again because I kept thinking, I have to penetrate this. I have to get to what it is offering me. And that happens. It will happen. But that's where in our, you know, get it any way you want culture, we have to be very careful. We have been conditioned to expect things to arrive to us already on the plate. And if we use that within our Dharma practice, we are going to miss a great deal. And, you know, it's just so wonderful when suddenly something that just was not speaking to you starts speaking to you. It's like, it's amazing. It's so enriching. It's so fulfilling. It's so satisfying. And then having that experience, you think, oh, well, when that encounter, you encounter that kind of dryness again, it's like, oh, I know what to do. I just have to keep working with it. I have to have faith. And that just keeps happening, that verification. To hear the Dharma, to reflect, and then to bring that into our practice, our daily practice. That is how you carry yourself. That is how I carry myself. And that's how we, doing that, carrying ourselves in this boat. So there's the boat of your body and mind. There's the boat of the Sangha. There's the boat of our country, of our world. Dogen says, just forget yourself for now and practice inwardly. See that every view you have is based on the self. So when any notion of self arises, sit quietly and contemplate it. Is there a real basis for it anywhere? Does it sit anywhere? Can you touch it? Can you locate it? Is it solid? Does it exist apart from you? Anything you see, mind, thought, awareness, knowledge, your breath going in and out, which ties your whole lifetime together, what are these things anyway? None of these are the self. How can you be attached to anything? Dogen says, practice calls forth enlightenment, your treasure house. It doesn't come from the outside. How enlightenment functions is through practice. So if you turn the eye of enlightenment and reflect back on the realm of practice, if you think of it as walking 100 steps, if you measure, if you judge, if you try and figure out where are you will be as far from true practice as heaven is from earth. Now, just step back. Stop. Turn the light around and leap. Leap. So, having this precious human life, we are here today. This is why teachers say to be diligent in practice, day and night. You know, awareness is not a burden. Mindfulness is not a chore. The precepts are not binding. You know, what we see more and more when we look is how binding and dragging and thick living as samsara is. That yes, in the beginning, practice is challenging. Yes. But we do so many things that are challenging. We do so many things that demand so much of us. An old poem says, those who search for the way apart from themselves cannot realize it. You will only know your old discriminating consciousness. This is the cause of the endless cycle of birth and death. Yet, so many people will take this as their true person, as who you are, as what this life is. So what these teachers have been shouting out for 2,500 years is right here, there is another path. Right here, there is a true person. Right here within this precious human life, there is peace, there is true rest, there is joy. So thank you to all of you who have been with us this weekend. It was really a pleasure to have you. I hope we meet you face to face at some point in the future, those of you who've never been here. And please continue on your path. And if this is your path, we will hope to see you again. And thank you to all of you who are here with us this afternoon. I hope you're having a splendid day.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.